Welcome to the Davis Arts Center Poetry Series. Thank you for coming. We have a wonderful poet today, Mary Mackey. My name is James Lee Job. We'll have the featured poet. There'll be a break to sell some books, and I do hope you buy some. Books are marvelous things to own, and they make great gifts, too. You know, don't forget that cousin that loves poetry, right? And they mail easily. Restrooms are here and here. And there's an open mic that we'll finish up with at the end. You can sign up here. And those are for 5-minute slots. And to open with, I brought a poem by Mary Mackey. This is called Witness. Once there were beasts called elephants. When one could not get food, the others fed her. They were taken for their tusks, which were made into bracelets and piano keys, and their feet, which were made into footstools. The seals were made into hats and coats. The salmon were fished out of the rivers and eaten. The ostriches were taken for plumes for hats. The giraffes became seat covers. There were once trees older than our oldest cities, with trunks as thick as the pillars of temples. Near the end, people tried to save them by sitting in the tops, but they were forced down and the trees became plywood. Swordfish were served in fine homes on long polished tables covered with exotic sauces. Bones of wild mules were ground up for glue. Mostly, it happened by accident. No one meant to get rid of the frogs. At night, they used to sing so loudly, we had to shout over the sound of them. And then one summer, they sang softly. And then one summer, they stopped singing. The honeybees died of some kind of virus. And then the crops failed. And the fruit trees stopped bearing. And a great silence spread over the fields. Small things died, things we hardly noticed. Wild grasses, obscure fish, plants that didn't flower, bacteria, tiny brown birds. A kind of grasshopper that lived only in Africa. A plant that grew high up in a tree in the Amazon where no human being had ever seen it. A biting gnat that people were glad to see go. Clothes moths, a Siberian squirrel. Some weeds along the side of the highway. Some silly-looking thing that lived in the sand that the curlews ate. Some tiny green plankton that floated in the sea that no one knew about. Soon, only the oldest of us could remember a time when we woke to the humming of locusts. When a coyote danced in the sagebrush, a beaver felled a tree, a rhinoceros bathed in the mud, and wild roses bloomed in the ditches beside the roads on summer evenings. Large birds used to cross the thin golden plate of the sun in the forest. The whippoorwill sang all night long. Mary Mackey is the author of 14 novels and 8 collections of poetry, including Sugar Zone, which won an Oakland Pen Josephine Miles Award for Literary Excellence, and The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams, which won a CIIS Women's Spirituality Book Award. Ladies and gentlemen, sometimes the dark clouds part, and a single beam of sunlight shines down on the valley, and we are blessed with someone like Mary Mackey. Please welcome her.
That makes me want to found my own religion, you know. Thank you. That was a wonderful introduction. I'm happy to be here. I'm going to be reading today out of my new book, The Jaguars That Prowl Our Dreams. I'm going to take you to Western Kentucky. I'm going to take you into the rainforests of Costa Rica and the Amazon. And I'm going to maybe take you to another perspective on Shakespeare's heroines. So we're going to kind of go through some of that. I promise not to read all the poems slowly either. I'm going to start with Western Kentucky. Let's see here. And the first poem I'm going to read is called Kin. It's because I'm Irish. With a name like Mary Mackey, it would hardly be possible to be anything else. But my mother's maiden name was McGinnis, so I've got it from both sides, County Cork. And so I'm going to read about my family in Western Kentucky, where I spent summers on a very remote farm in Western Kentucky on the Ohio River, where there was no electricity, and we had a spring house, and we got to pull things up by the well in buckets, and, you know, all sorts of things like this. And I think it's the reason I've written historical fiction, because I actually lived about 150 years in the past. So I'm essentially a little over 200 in terms of culture. So this is a bit about them. It's a small town. It's called Kin. And by the way, I'm bilingual in Yankee and Southern, so I may break into a bit of Southern at some point. We were related to everybody in Hamilton County, literally everybody, judges and lawyers and county clerks and barbers and druggists and soda jerks and moonshiners and farmers and ferry boat captains and the rich people and the big white houses and the poor ones down in the slough. Total strangers would come up to you as soon as they saw you on the street, throw their arms around you and say, "My great-great-grandma's buried next to your great-great-grandma," or, "I'm your cousin 17 times removed on your great-uncle's side," or, my, you look just like your daddy. Did he ever get out of prison? Great-grandfather Ebenezer wanted boys, but God didn't come through. So he gave all his daughters boys' names, Aunt Christopher, Aunt Ebenezer, and Aunt Fenwick. When Ida Alice, the youngest, was born, he gave up and saddled her with two old maids' names, saying, "No one's going to marry into a family of girls." How they got here. In steerage, so hungry they ate the green slime off the walls of the hold. Indentured, grubbing the burdock out of the corn with short-handled hoes, sucking on stones, chewing weeds, sleeping with the cattle. Sometimes, when a tired, red-knuckled woman turned toward a man, he caught in her face a glimpse of the bruised beauty of a winter sunset. On the day they finally bought their freedom, burned their indentures, and left the coast of Virginia behind to follow Mr. Boone through the gap, their only possessions were 5 wool blankets, 3 bags of flour, 1/2 pound of salt, 2 iron skillets, an axe, and a small leather bag half filled with seed corn. I'm now going to read you, let's see, there's no children in here, all right, because it's not sexually offensive to children. It just might give them screaming nightmares and you couldn't get them to bed well. This is a, well, you'll see. This is, I wrote this first poem. I was feeling kind of sorry for myself because I felt like politically and, you know, in just terms of everything else, the country was very polarized, and I was feeling, you know, kind of depressed about it. And then I started thinking about my great aunts in Kentucky, and I started thinking kind of things they went through. So these are sort of a series of poems that kind of memorialized the strength of women, and you're welcome to scream at any time. This is called "Whenever I Feel Like Complaining." I remember my great aunt Abby, who 3 days before she turned 76, hand-shucked 40 acres of corn after it was beaten down by a hailstorm, standing on one leg, because the other had been eaten off by a hog, which had also eaten off one of her arms, meaning she did it one-legged and one-handed in the pouring rain. Et. Dialectical past tense and past participle of eat. Middle English etten, from Old English etan, akin to the Old High German essen, to eat, Latin edere, Greek edamame. "Your great aunt Abby suffered a farm accident," my mother says. "What she means," my father says, "is a hog et your aunt Abby." "Et all of her?" I ask. "No, just her leg and part of her left arm." "Think she'll live?" "I expect so. Those Walker girls are tough." "John," my mother screams, "how could you stand there and talk about this to Mary as if it's normal?" While listening to Pincus Zuckerman play Mozart, "Couldn't you at least have said eaten?" my mother whispers. "You're a doctor, a well-educated man." "No one ever says someone was eaten by hogs," my father whispers. "They are it. It's the only possible word." "I cannot," whispers my mother, turning pale. "Cannot stand for, cannot bear to." My mother never finished that sentence, so we never knew if it was the grammar or the hogs that bothered her most. I prove I am my mother's daughter. "My great aunt has suffered a farm accident," I told my Harvard roommates. "She had a fall." Why my mother gave up pork forever. For Christmas, they sent us the ham. Jesus on a scarf. My people weren't religious. They went to church on Sunday mostly for the company, to learn the going price for shoats, and to grab a funeral parlor fan or two when the temperature turned hot come August. The only praying I ever heard about was when the hog ate off Aunt Abby's leg, and she sent away to a radio preacher for a magic scarf with the face of Jesus on it that was supposed to make it grow back. She tried the Jesus scarf for a while with no results, sent her artificial leg out to have the knee readjusted, and gave up on God. And I'm going to just read just a little bit more of these because this is the first series in the book. You know, small farming communities all over the world are somewhat alike. They have land disputes with their neighbors. You know, there's always sort of the people next door. And my great aunts used to always talk about how when anybody in the family got sick, the Colbys, the neighbors, would go out and they'd pace the land. They'd mark it off because they were thinking of buying it, you know. So as soon as somebody took to their bed, the neighbors would be out there pacing the fence rows, trying to see how much land there was for it. And so this is kind of in memorial to this. This is called, "For 12 Generations We Hated the Colbys." But these people never forgot anything. I mean, you know, they had gossip going. And I was a little girl, I'd sit on the porch and they'd gossip. And they'd tell these horrible tales. They had no filters about this stuff. They'd tell about, you know, how people axe murdered their wives and, you know, all sorts of little boys got baled with baling wire when they went out in the field. And it turned out like this, some of these things took place in the 1700s, and they were still telling these stories about their neighbors. This is the kind of town where my mother, who was a Yankee, meaning she lived 50 miles to the north, called up and tried to give my grandmother, through the only florist in town, some geraniums for Mother's Day. And the florist said, "I'm not going to fill that order." And my mother said, "Why?" And she said, "Because Alice Mackey has a black thumb. She can't grow anything. I'm not sending flowers to die at her house." You know, so it was like you couldn't escape it. You had this reputation that just was back like a cape that you trailed with you. So this is called "For 12 Generations We Hated the Colbys." The Colbys were bad, evil, full of meanness. Every time one of our people fell sick, the Colbys came out and paced our fence lines, figuring to buy our land cheap before the corpse was cold. When Aunt Kitty married a Colby, things fell apart like Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, only with shotguns. Aunt Kitty's husband, Mr. Colby, took her to Detroit, where he went to college and got an education. When the two came back, the Colbys drove them off the place and wrote them out of the will. Aunt Kitty and her husband had to go sharecrop in Henderson. When the last Walker girl died, and the Walker's my family, when the last Walker girl died and was put in the family graveyard, the Colbys finally got our farm. They tore down the house. They tore down the chicken coops. They tore down the barn and shed and the smokehouse where the hams had been smoked and taken down to New Orleans on flatboats. They pulled up the stones that had the names of the uncles who drowned in the Colorado Gold Rush carved on them, chopped down the orchard, and took a bush hog to the blackberry vines. The Colbys planted corn, long green rows, greener than where our hogs had wallowed, greener where our chickens had scratched. Corn, corn, as far as you could see. Rows and rows of it rolling across those Kentucky hills, right down to the bottom lands where the Ohio brought them the topsoil it had stolen from the Yankees. We never did find out what happened to Uncle Wid's mules. The only thing the Colbys didn't touch was the family graveyard, because there were Colbys buried there. How they got there, nobody knows. I think maybe they snuck in the night. Okay, so now I'm going to take you to a completely different world here. A lot of these poems go back to some of them were written as early as 1968, and some of them come from 1974. This is a collection of poems. It's got 48 new poems recently written, you know, in the last 2 years, and it's got poems from my 7 previous collections. And what's interesting about some of the earlier poems is how they stand up. I mean, how they could have been written yesterday. I'm going to read you some poems. I was originally going to write a little book back in about 1974 called "A Threatening Letter to Shakespeare," and where I had Shakespeare's women sort of speak back. And so I'm going to read a couple of those. I'm going to read you Juliet. Juliet. I was a green girl, 14 and fresh. My breasts curled so tight in my chest that they ached. Time pulled through my body like sap, and I thought love grew everywhere like milkweed. Romeo was a human swagger. We drove over the state line near the end of spring and were married by a judge in striped pajamas who loaned us a cigar band for a ring. I said, look how the dogwood is in bloom, like the lips of small children in the naked woods. And Romeo said, let's stop for a cheeseburger. I said, when I see a river, I imagine a mouth at the end that could swallow us both. I said, this is the beginning of a great adventure. I said, I've escaped into love, and I'll never be unhappy again. But there was wax to take off the kitchen floor, and diapers to wash, and Romeo snored. And I found that love grows around the heart like the bark on a tree, and we had three children, and nobody died, and you can wait forever for the balcony scene. Okay. Lady Macbeth. Lady Macbeth. I have seen her at the corporation charm classes, learning how to be the perfect company wife. She relocates every 3 years with no complaint, serving the same dry martini from Denver to Dallas. Picking the right mate is important for a Scottish nobleman on his way up. The castle is drafty. She has nothing to do. In the afternoon, she drinks and walks the battlements. Why don't you try to get ahead, she nags her husband at night when he's trying to go to sleep. Why don't you try to be somebody for a change? The king in charge is no smarter than you. Why, he's not even really executive material. Play golf with the old man. Take him falconing on the moor. Invite him back to dinner, and when his back's turned, we'll kill him with a butter knife. These helpless women are the most dangerous. Someday, she tells her husband, sucking the pimento out of an olive, someday I will be queen. At night, she walks in her sleep, blood on her lips, blood on her hands. Her husband takes up more than half the bed. We're dividing one life, she mutters. We're dividing one life, and I want all of it. And I have Desdemona and Ophelia and several others in the same series. I'm going to read you another one here, kind of in a similar... similar mode. Here we go. And this was written probably about 1979. It's called The Woman in the Moon. My great-grandmother married at 16 a blue-eyed Irish woodworker who promised to build her a life out of applewood and cherry. Instead, he gave her 13 children, drank up the rent, and died of blood poisoning while building a carriage shaped like a shoe. For 40 years, she lived alone, dressed in black, like a retired witch, in a house full of chests and chairs and wooden clocks, waiting for him to come home again. When she was 80 and I was 4, we met. Her skin was so thin by then that you could see her veins like grain. She kept her teeth in a glass of water and her heart in a rosewood box by the door. There's a woman in the moon, my great-grandmother told me, who carries a bundle of sticks on her back. Each month she swells, each month she declines. Like many women, she's married a burden and must bear it forever across the sky. Life bends us, she told me. My own life was scrap wood. My own life was sorrow, thick as a board. Tell all your daughters to build something better. Burn kindling, not carry. Keep one eye on the sky. Okay, I'm going to get a little water here, and then I'm going to take you to the tropics. Anybody ever been to Brazil? Angus, you don't count, because you're the person who took me to Brazil. How about Costa Rica? Okay. Well, I lived in Costa Rica in the late 60s in a biological field station in the jungle, which is now part of a park, but at the time it was the jungle. We hadn't gotten the term rainforest really down yet. And they reprovisioned us with a little plane. There were no roads, a little plane that came in if they remembered us, but they often didn't. And the plane would fly around and go like this to get the cattle out of the place. Then it would land on the thing, and little boys would come up with plastic bottles full of airplane fuel and fuel the airplane. And we'd take off, and, you know, if you had to go somewhere, you'd have to. It was the only way out. Otherwise, it was 2 weeks through the jungle. It was very bad. So you had to be a little careful. And it was quite an experience. And the planes, if I had known the statistics about the planes, I never would have gotten in them. One time we were coming into San Jose, which is in kind of a basin over the mountains, and we just started gliding. We had run out of gas. And that wouldn't have been so bad, except the altimeter was broken. And the plane had a woman with chickens and a small pear tree, and it was terribly overloaded. But we got in okay, you know, and I was too young and stupid to realize how young and stupid I was, actually. And so living there, I consider myself very lucky because I saw the jungle, the rainforest, at its height. It was completely untouched. It was, you know, virgin forest. It was full of animals. Howler monkeys lived outside the door. You know, vampire bats would sometimes fall on your sleeping bag and start crawling up to get to you. There was, you know, you could swing from vines like Tarzan, only you had to shake the vines first because snakes live in the vines. You want to shake it to get the snakes out, and then you could swing in the vines. And, you know, it was just an amazing world. And I've spent a lot of my, you know, I didn't write about it for a long time, but I've, you know, found in my poetry a way to sort of talk about the incredible ecstatic beauty of this nature that's beyond human laws and beyond human civilization. It's just in its primal. And when you're in it, you're just another animal in the forest. I mean, you know, there's no special rules for you. If you get hurt, you're not going to call 911. You know. So I want to read one poem here that sort of talks about how beautiful the forest is. It's a very short poem, and it's called The Invisible Forest of Amapá. Amapá is part of Brazil that is still about 90% intact with rainforest, and invisible in that it hasn't been mapped for Europeans, haven't mapped it. I mean, the indigenous people know it, but they haven't. And I just want to, it's just sort of an evocation of the beauty. And I do think that many of us are a lucky generation because we saw the world in many ways that's impossible to see it. Like, I got to dive the Great Barrier Reef before there was any problems with it. And now, you know, hundreds of miles of it have been destroyed. A lot of the forest I saw in Costa Rica has a very good program of preservation, but about 90% has been cut down. So I consider myself very, very, very fortunate to have seen the world in all its kind of, pre-climate change glory, really. The invisible forests of Amapá, these are still there. So. And the first names are names of animals which are endangered, but they still exist in this part of Brazil. The invisible forests of Amapá, crested capuchin, nectar bat, three-toed sloth, golden lion tamarin, red-handed howling monkey, dark-throated seed eater, blue-winged macaw, great rivers veiled in steam, 60 billion trees reaching toward a sky so green it burns like copper. The jaguars that prowl our dreams. The first words in this poem are the tributaries of the Amazon. The last words are tribes that no longer exist due to European incursions, mostly because of disease. And there's a little Portuguese in here, but don't panic. It's perfectly understandable, even if you don't speak a word of Portuguese. Anybody speak Portuguese? No, you don't count either, Angus, still. Anybody in here speak Portuguese? No, okay, good. Because my accent is probably not perfect, but it's okay. The jaguars that prowl our dreams. Up on the Orinoco, Rio Negro, Solimões, Tocantins, Xingu, Javaré, they're drinking the bebida, preta, black drink, snake, vine, ayahuasca, yagé, blood of the great anaconda, with the smoke of burning rainforests in their nostrils and o gosto de cenizas, taste of ashes on their tongues. Eles está comendo. They're eating purple snails, powdered viper venom, largatas esmagadas, flowers that dye their lips the color of blood, singing of cities of blue glass and the jaguars that prowl our dreams. O que mais? What else are they seeing? O que mais? What else do they know? They're not saying, they're not telling. They're calling on the ghost tribes instead. Ghosts of the Tupinimba, Tupanquim, Amaré, lost upriver, forever lost in the burning world. Painted tigers. By the way, the jaguars of the jungle, they're not the black jaguars you might think of. They're more like tigers. They're big and they're sort of striped. Are they spotted or striped? They're spotted. Yeah, they're spotted. But they're big beasts. They weigh several hundred pounds and they're the biggest predator. And you know, you do not want to try to pet one of these things, you know, or take a selfie with it. I don't think so. You know. Okay, so here we go. This is called painted tigers. And onça pintada, painted tigers, is the Portuguese for these jaguars in general. And by the way, the snake of stars that's mentioned at the beginning is a indigenous cosmology where the people of the Amazon see the southern hemisphere. You know, the stars are different. They see a great snake in the sky. There's a great snake up there. Painted tigers. Overhead, a great snake of stars is coiling and uncoiling like boiling water, while beneath the river the ghost trees sleep like abandoned dogs. When you come here, blind and mute, to dream beside this forgotten shore, when your eyes are too heavy with remorse to see inward, your lips too dry with lies to form words, and your brain filled with everything you've abandoned, the painted tigers will stalk you on soft pads, admiring the vulnerability of your neck, the tenderness of your flesh, marveling at the way you walk along these paths, never looking back, as if the jungle were yours, as if an animal without teeth or claws could survive in this place where even the smallest insect is death's messenger. How gently they will put their muzzles to your mouth, how quickly suck out your breath, how ecstatically breathe in your dreams. The last thing you will feel will be the softness of their fur and the quick joy of their teeth. Yeah. This is a kind of love. This is, you know, how many climate change love poems do you suppose there are out there? This may be a first. It's called In This Burning World. On the long road down the hill, the cobblestones tip us like drunken sailors under a sky smeared with volcanic dust. At the bottom lies a sea clear and pale as the skin beneath our arms. In this burning world where we can never stop to rest, you reach out and brush the tips of my fingers. Our parched skin flakes off in tiny bits and floats up toward the sun, riding the great cone-shaped thermals of this slowly turning planet. We're two birds gliding through an empty sky, lost, uncertain, filled with unreasonable joy. Now, this poem is called When Jaguars Lick Salt From My Hands, and I want to just say something about, I talk about ayahuasca and things in here. The reason I do that is not because I actually use ayahuasca, which I don't and haven't, but because when I was an undergraduate, I worked as a student assistant to a guy named Richard Evans Schultes, who was the invented a branch of science called ethnobotany, where he studied the use of people in plants. And he went into the jungles of South America. He's really kind of my inspiration. And he brought back, he was the first one that brought ayahuasca back to the States, to European knowledge. And I was classifying everything. You know, I classified a trunk full of this stuff back in the 60s, a trunk full of ayahuasca. But he also taught a class in hallucinogens, which I audited. And so I found out a lot about them. And one thing about the shamans of the Amazon do is when they take ayahuasca, which is a hallucinogen for vision trips, it's a religious thing, the ayahuasca in the first place is a special mixture that's traditionally done. And it's kind of kept around with rules about how it's used. But one thing they do is they become jaguars, and they prowl the other world as jaguars. And so that's part of the mythos of this book, is the prowling of the other world as jaguars. And so this is a kind of feeling of initiation, of going into other worlds. When jaguars lick salt from my hands. Burning jungles once spread out beneath me, carpets of flame that moved and twisted, following the silver snake of the river like an evil prophecy. I remember a hot, green day when jaguars licked salt from my hands and the shamans turned my body into a bag of birds, how they pried open my mouth and stuffed me with parrots, macaws, crested eagles, fire eyes, monjitas, tinamous, and cochingas, filled my lungs with feathers, stripped off my skin, and replaced it with a layer of greasy down the color of rotten mangoes. I remember how my hands became claws, my nails talons. How when I tried to speak, 1,000 beaks came out of my mouth, and my tongue broke off at the tip. When they were finished, they wrapped me in a blanket of thorns, tied ropes around their ankles, and climbed the crest of great trees. Fly, they commanded, throwing me naked and nestless into air so hot and thick, I thought at first I could swim in it. I flew forever before I hit the ground, flew like a hawk looking for prey, like a vulture looking for death. Now back in these lands where the leaves turn blood red and pepper fruits fall to the ground, and everything has a golden diminishment, as if light itself is finally being observed to die. I can still feel those birds trying to beat themselves out of my skull, and I almost take flight again over that vast jungle of nightmares and hallucinations. So I lived off and on in Costa Rica for 6 years, and then I've spent some time in the Amazon also. And this is called, "In Those Days, Rivers Could Not Cool Me." Let's see how we're doing here. Gee, I'm going to read for now. I once lived in places where volcanoes erupted, the water was poison, and night swarmed with termites that tasted like glue. There were rooms where I lay so wrapped in fever that the fans overhead seemed ecstatic in their whirling. Rooms where I saw light the color of blood and bruised plums, had hallucinations, dreams, terrors so great they set me shrieking. Once for 4 hours straight I spoke in rhymed couplets and no one could make me shut up until I threw off the sheets and ran into the tropical night like a woman on fire. In those days, rivers could not cool me, threats could not subdue me. I burned and burned with illness, lust, and fear, and your lightest touch seemed like a blow. Later, I cooked a monkey in cream sauce and we ate it as jungle rats ran the rafters over our heads. The next afternoon, I nearly stepped on a 9-foot fer de lance. Only a mad woman could have loved such a life, but I do love the strangeness of it, the non-humanness of it, the sure knowledge that death was so small and close it could buzz in my ear. I'm going to finish up here with a couple of love poems. And this one is called Suspension. At 9 in the evening, when the light was long and the air still tasted of dust, hot as ashes, we went into the river together, open-mouthed and naked, to consider the proposition that air was not worth breathing. That night, our lives were shadows on the bottom, vanishing in fish and reeds. Think of this the next time you let water hold you, how love was once a short summer night, sweet and despairing. Where is my lover? Have you seen him? I've wandered through the city calling his name. My friends pity me. They say I've gone mad. At night they sit in tight circles lamenting my delusions. She loves a phantom, they say. She loves no one. Ah, but they've never lain beside you in the tall grass where the deer come down to lick the summer salt. They've never felt your lips move like wings across the breasts of the hills. And the last one I'm going to read is the Kama Sutra of Kindness, position number 3. I have 5 Kama Sutra of Kindness poems written over about a 40-year period. And this is position number 3. I figured there were enough sex manuals, we needed some manuals on kindness. So this is my Kama Sutra of Kindness, position number 3. It's easy to love through a cold spring, when the poles of the willows turn green, pollen falls like a yellow curtain, and the scent of paper whites clots the air. But to love for a lifetime takes talent. You have to mix yourself with the strange beauty of someone else. Wake each morning for 72,000 mornings in a row so breathed and bound and tangled that you can hardly sort out your arms and legs. You have to find forgiveness in everything, even ink stains and broken cups. You have to be willing to move through life together, the way the long grasses move in a field when you careen blindly toward the other side. There's never going to be anything straight or predictable about your path, except the flattening and the springing back. You just go on walking for years, hand in hand, waist deep in the weeds, bent slightly forward like two question marks. And all the while, it burns, my dear. It burns beautifully above you and goes on burning like a relentless sun. Thank you.